Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. How are you?
I'm all right. Although I haven't really got much to say today. I think we're this is going to be like a sort of Seinfeld episode.
Where why is that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what is there, Gary? What's left?
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
Sorry, I took a bit of a left turn. We were just saying what we're going to talk about in the intro. We haven't really got anything.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I have something, which is I'm still making my album, and
no,
you haven't heard any yet. And
I need
to get you down to play some bloody bass, right?
Yes, you do.
Yeah, but you're so ubiquitous at the moment.
I am rather ubiquitous. I know, it's funny, and it's there's something I'm going to bring up with our fabulous guest today. Is that, yeah, because I do seem to be playing with all sorts of people, most of whom I can't say, because this is the funny thing. Until someone says they're doing something, you can't, you know, really say you're doing anything. I mean, like, I can say that I've been recording with David Gilmour because Polly puts everything up on the Instagram feed.
Oh, yeah, this is it, you see, because you don't want to trip up, do you? And then you're persona non gratis.
After my unfortunate incident when I accidentally leaked the name of the song that Jimmy Page was going to be doing with Leona Lewis at the end closing of the Beijing Olympics.
Oh, yeah. Tell the story. Go on. What happened?
Oh, it's a bit... Well, I played on... We did a whole lot of love. It was amazing. We did it in Olympic Studio 2 with all the amps. Just me, the fantastic Jeff Doug Moore on drums. And Jimmy did it as a power trio. And there was an orchestra on it that Philip Shepherd had put together. And then Leona Lewis came and sang it. And I had to sign this big NDA saying, obviously, you can't, you know, say whatever. No, of course, I'm not going to say anything. Then it was in all the papers. Jimmy Page to close the, you know. And I thought, oh, well, that's all right. I can say if they're saying he's doing it. But then I wrote, this was before social media. I just wrote on my blog. I had a blog at the time. And I had a radio show. And I just interviewed Brian Cox. And I was talking about that. And I just said, oh, by the way, when you hear Jimmy Page play Leona...
Not fuck off, Brian Cox.
No. The imagine if the universe was a giant IKEA bag. No, that one.
Okay. Yeah.
and I said, well, yeah, when you hear them playing Whole Lot of Love, that's me playing bass on it. And of course, no one had said what the song was.
So were you banned from the towers?
I was the number one. In fact, the next time I saw, dragons were sent out. It was dragons. But apparently, I was the number one item on Google News the next morning. I had lawyers calling me from Beijing. It was really awful.
So Jimmy,
In the Sun, I was the aptly named Guy Pratt.
Oh God! So was Jimmy standing in a pentagram, or was it pentagrams you stand in?
Yes, it is a pentagram. No,
pentangles.
It was, and I felt awful. I felt terrible. Although, think about it. There's only like two or three songs that they were going to play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Did he ever speak to you again?
Yes, and do you know where it was? I meant it? It was at your book launch. It was at your book launch.
Because I heard him speaking in tongues like a snake at you.
That's right. I had to burn a lot of sage before I came in.
But anyway, you made up.
We made up, yes.
Thank God for that. So you had nothing to talk about, but of course you did have yourself to talk about, which is always nice.
You made me.
I made you. Sophie Ellis-Bextor, she's on because of you as well. Because of you. Sorry, I'm shouting today. Sorry,
you are shouting.
Ben.
You are not. I'm not shouting. Now I am shouting.
So, because we thought it would be great, because this Murder on the Dance Floor re-emergence because of Saltburn the movie, which is utterly phenomenal. I mean, it's been a global ticky-tocky hit everywhere. And you
did
played
you just
on,
say Ticky Tocky Hit?
You played on the original.
I did play on the original. It's and it's fantastic. But also, I mean, we should point out that, you know, Sophie is a mutual friend of ours, and as and indeed, and she's a friend to bass players. She's married to one.
Bass player.
Yeah, and we and she's fabulous, Sophie, and she's a great torchbearer for so many things. Yeah, and she's got this sort of indie Britpop background as absolutely. Well with the audience. And yeah, she does so much great stuff. And yes, there is. We all said. I mean, it's amazing how Murder on the Dance Floor has blown up after 21 years. And it's just, and it's for me, it's just fantastic to finally once be on a record to tell that my son actually thinks is cool.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. But her career has, you're right, and it's really developed. And obviously, there's lots of, you know, there was Spiller, Groovejet, and dance stuff, and her work with Greg Alexander, of course. And then later on, you know, the last three albums with Ed Harcourt. Very serious, and amazing lyrics on those records. And, you know, I don't think the world truly knows what she does. And this might be an opportunity to find out.
Let's get her on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. To
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello.
Thank you
Sophie.
So much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.
Yes, in your clearly insane schedule.
Well, you know what? I'm actually free for the rest of the day, but I think you guys are going to do a morning, so hopefully this has been all right for you. But it does mean there's no rush. We can chat for until you're happy. But yeah, it has been quite busy. But it's all right.
You know what?
It's boring when people talk about being busy, isn't it?
No, but I tell you what, it is kind of important because I was just talking to my wife, Lauren. Of course, we've known you for many years.
Yes.
But you are one of the hardest working people I've ever known. And
really?
If you don't stop working, plus you got five boys that you manage and keep brilliantly and do all of those things. Spinning plates, obviously, is your thing. But it's, you do, you've it's never stopped for you.
Well, I think actually probably key to a lot of that is the fact that it did, but a long time ago now, but I was in my first band when I was a teenager, and then we got signed when I was 18 and then dropped by the time I was 20. So I did have quite a big stop. And I think after that was when probably it kind of crystallized this idea of like being, you know, really grateful every time there's things put in front of me to do, actually, because I know that I don't like the feeling when I'm not working. So I think that probably kind of sealed the deal for the work ethic, really, because I knew what it felt like to have it all go quiet.
That thing with that band, with the audience, because it was an incredible arc, wasn't it? You're saying, but it's funny, you forget when you're young, just how much quicker things are happening. It probably seemed like it was ages to you at the time, because you're getting like, what, weren't you NME Band of the Year? And
yeah, I don't know if it did feel ages. I think it more felt like kind of ridiculous, because we had this very steep up and lots of hype and then a very steep crash down as well. So I felt like in that 4 years that I was in the band, I sort of learnt so much. And I think it kind of laid the foundation for everything that followed, just in terms of everything I'd taken on board and was watching and listening to and thinking about in that time. So I think it really, I wouldn't have approached how I've done the rest of my solo career the way I have if I hadn't had that experience. It was a lot of learning in a short amount of time, really.
Because I was listening to, I was having a listen this morning to the audience, and it's great stuff. I think that they're kind of more like a sort of 80s indie band than a Britpop-y band. That hasn't quite got the one thing all the Britpop bands has had this sort of certain exuberance, and you're a bit more, you know, there's something slightly Morrissey-esque in some of your vocals and stuff.
Definitely, I know exactly.
What is interesting is you don't listen to it and go, that girl needs to be singing disco.
No, you don't. And actually, that girl did not think that either. Yes. You know, I was very firmly in my indie world, really. And also, you know, it's not something I'd been planning. I started singing in the band because someone had said, oh, I've got a friend who's looking for a singer. And I thought, oh, that'll be something to tell my kids I did once. I didn't expect to find the thing that made sense to me in that way. So at the time, I think it was just, a series of experiences, really. And I didn't write any of the songs. So I think I just sort of stepped into it and was kind of feeling my way a little bit in amongst, you know, what had been created around me.
It's not completely true that it was just sort of, it was an anomaly that should have been in the 80s, because there were bands like the Sundays, wasn't there, that were around at the same time, and had a very similar sort of connection, dream pop, really.
Yeah, that's a good way of phrasing it, I think. And actually, it's the same drummer, Patch Hannon, was in the Sundays and then did the audience as well.
Did you write none of the lyrics? Because, I mean, they sound like your songs. A pessimist is never disappointed. Sounds like something that you may have written.
Yeah, no, I didn't actually. So the songwriter is a guy called Billy, who I've kept in touch with actually. And I think he found it quite sort of inspiring to, because he at the time was, I think, about 30 and I was like 16, 17. So he was kind of going back into how it felt to be teenage, actually, I think. And that was kind of the link. But no, I wasn't, not only did I not write, I wasn't very interested in writing actually at the time. I think I was just focusing on seeing how it felt to perform and to record and this whole new world and going on tour and all that kind of thing and just taking all of that stuff in.
Because what came next was because you did actually have a publishing deal.
Yes, so I was signed into a publishing deal. I know.
How jammy is that?
Well, also, I must confess, I didn't quite understand that that was what was happening. So when the audience were signed, so we signed as a band to Universal, Mercury, and then the publishing we signed, but it was only Billy and I that signed the deal. And I didn't quite understand what that meant, if I'm honest, because it was all brave new world to me. So I was signed into this deal. And then the band all split up and he went off and did something else for a while. So then the only person that kept the publishing deal was me. And of course, that sort of stayed dormant for a while. I was thinking about doing other things. And then they were the ones who received this instrumental of Groove Jet. And someone in their offices said, oh, we should send that to Sophie. I think maybe that might work for her. But if I hadn't had that publishing deal, I don't think any of the rest of it would have happened, actually.
Let me just go back on sorry, Guy, let me just go back on the audience, because your dad directed the videos for that, didn't he?
He did, that's right, yeah. He did the first three.
So was there a sense of being chaperoned as well? You were being sort of slightly looked after?
I think so, because, you know, I felt quite grown up, but I was only sort of 16, 17, 18. And I think my dad wanted to keep an eye on things. And also it was a skill set he could offer because he's a director. So he felt like I could get involved. And I think my dad had always loved music so, so much and was always playing me music and telling me about band histories. And he's very knowledgeable, lots of facts. He'd take me up to this top room in the house where we were when I was little and had all his vinyl. He'd just pick out things and play me stuff and go, listen to this and how, imagine this moment when you first heard it. So I think for him, seeing me actually do the thing of coming, you know, joining a band and going on the road and doing all these gigs, he was really like, I love this world. And I think for him, directing the videos was a nice connection that we had as well.
I noticed when you did Inheritance tracks, you picked Comfortably Numb.
Yeah. Yeah, because that was my first gig that I went to. I would have been 8 or 9, and my dad took me. And then
that's with Guy playing.
That would have been me playing.
I know. How funny was that?
Was that at Wembley?
Yes, Wembley. Yes, exactly.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And then again to seal the deal.
You didn't like it, did you?
Well, I was a bit bored.
I mean, you were a bit young. I mean,
I didn't quite understand what was happening, because actually I thought the music was really exciting.
Neither did I.
was there one really annoying bloke stomping around over the stage? Yes.
I just was confused because the music was really high drama and there was lots happening and light shows and, you know, inflatable pigs and planes and all sorts. But a lot of the crowd were just staying quite still and just nodding. That was kind of the max setting, was a nod. Which I now recognise was mass appreciation. But at the time I was like, why is nobody dancing? So I think, I was a bit confused by aspects. But my dad was just loving it and going, look at this. And there's a light that comes out in a minute and it's brighter than the sun. he was just so excited to sort of go through, see it through my eyes. And then he took me again when I was 11. So my first and my second gig were Pink Floyd, yes.
Wow. Because I must say, having, you know, knowing your dad, he is quite an excitable person. Yes. I've actually been through the secret tunnels that go under the pavilion in Brighton. Ooh. With him. So, yeah.
You know when I didn't know Guy, but her dad's work has been mentioned on this programme before.
Really?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, because Jean-Jacques Burnel was on.
Oh, yes.
And he shot a little short with Jean-Jacques Burnel and Sarah Miles.
Yes.
I think it was called The Norfolk Coast.
Yes, The Norfolk Coast. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad's passionate about music, absolutely passionate. So, yeah, that's a big part of my kind of early musical education was through my dad, definitely.
And what about your mum? Obviously, she was a TV presenter, you know, famously on Blue Peter. So this is a showbiz family in a way, I guess, isn't it? Let's not say that. It's a family that's really interested in performance and the arts.
Yeah, definitely creative, more heavily on the television side. So my dad, my stepmom, my stepdad, my grandpa were all involved in the production side of TV. And then my mum, yeah, had gone to drama school and then ended up presenting. And I think the biggest gift that gave me was actually not thinking of any jobs as being on a different level to anything else. So when I thought about singing, it wasn't like, well, I have to kind of get, you know, a normal job or there's music somewhere over here in the ether. I could sort of see how it might work in a more, I suppose, a more like achievable, practical sense, really. And they didn't freak out too much when I finished my A-levels and then didn't go off to university, but I went and on the NME Brat Bus tour, actually. And they definitely could have said, what? That's not the plan. But they were pretty supportive of all of that. And I think that was an amazing thing that they were like that.
So did you get to go to the Blue Peter Garden when you were little?
Oh, yeah. All of that. Yeah, that was very much part of my childhood. My mum...
You must have grown up in a house that was just full of sticky-backed plastic.
Yeah, well, I was always hoping she'd bring home the mates.
Bottles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was the big hope, that she'd bring home what she just made on the telly. So
things without brand names.
Exactly. she was presenting Blue Peter when I was 4 till when I was 8, which is also the time that... So my dad and my mum split up when she started, pretty much around the same time. And then she'd met my stepdad, John, when I was 7. So that majority of that time was also my mum and my dad being single parents, which I think is significant because it meant that all of that was a lot more sort of intense, I suppose, because it was just me and my mum. So Blue Peter always felt weirdly like a sibling, which I know sounds really strange, but it was like a relative in my house. You know, all of it was so familiar and ever present.
Wow. And it's amazing because, you know, I'm much older than you, but Blue Peter still has that memory for me as well.
Yeah, it was massive. There weren't, you know, there's only 4 channels back then, you know, so it was, do you watch Blue Peter or do you watch...
4?
Yeah. We had 2. Guy and I had 2.
Well, it's still funny to think back though, isn't it? And my mum, I think this is really impressive. There was no auto cue then, so she would get the script the night before and have to learn it, ready to do the live broadcast to 12 million people, having learnt the script off by heart. I always find that a really amazing thing about my mum.
Wow, that's amazing, because they never dropped a beat.
No, they were so good.
I don't remember anyone, yeah.
Yeah, but, so professional.
But obviously Pink Floyd was given to you by your dad, but what was the sort of, what was the music that you found that became your own? Was there any, was there that moment of rebellion, if you like, or this is identity?
Very much so, yeah. So, and I would say my mum was also giving music more sort of the musical side, and Paul Simon, and yeah, there was music in both households basically. But for me, when Britpop happened in the mid 90s, that marked this massive shift where I was like, ah, this isn't music that's being handed down. This is aimed at me. You know, I get this, and I stepped into it wholeheartedly. I absolutely loved it. It was such a defining era and so exciting because also I was growing up in London. So, you know, bands that were coming to the city, I knew, you know, I could feasibly, if I timed it right, you know, go to the venues or see them in the pub around the corner and things like that. So it all felt exciting and, yeah, really vibrant.
Were you Blur or Oasis?
I actually liked both. I did like both. I mean, I suppose...
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. Come on.
I definitely fancied more of Blur when I was a teenager, for sure. No. But I think, I think for me, Blur is kind of, I was going to say it stood the test of time, but actually I heard Live Forever the other day and it's still such a beautiful bit of music. What a great song to hear when you're like 14, 15 and you're making those friendships that last a lifetime. Like, that's incredible. It's such a romance in it, isn't there?
Noel could write an anthem for sure, but you ended up working with Alex James,
I did. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. How was that?
It was great, because I think, so that's sort of a good example as well of how when I found myself a solo artist making pop music, I still wanted to keep my indie roots, really. So I ended up basically writing a list of all the people I'd ever liked and writing with them. So I worked with Alex. I remember writing songs with Path and the Wanna Dies, and I just would think, right, outside the box. It wasn't just about pop writers, it was about people where their music had really meant something to me.
Groove Jet, that was where I was introduced to you. You know,
that's where everyone was. And it's still like Murder is now, but it's a sort of all-time earworm, that one, isn't it? It's like,
well, because it's hard for me to be objective. Knows that one. I've definitely been singing it a long time, but happily I still really like it. So I think that song is the song I credit with sort of changing everything. Not solely because I'm sure it's significant that it was successful, but it was more about a mindset change for me, because I'd come from, you know, this indie band that had broken up. The indie press were being pretty hard work on me at the time. I wasn't feeling particularly happy in that world. And so when this dance track came my way, because now we're so used to people cross-pollinating genres, but then that was not the case. It was very much sort of stay in your lane. So to go from indie to Ibiza was really extraordinary. And I also did it thinking that that indie world would never know I did it. It was that separate in my head. So I just thought, I think this will be good for me to do something other. And through that, I realized I did actually really like aspects of dance music, because at first I thought I didn't like dance music as well. And I thought, actually, no, I do. And there's a skill in DJs and the story they tell. And hang on a minute, why don't I go back? This song's been sampled from a 70s song. I want to know more about that. I want to know about disco. I want to know about the storytelling that's in those vocals from those incredible vocalists of that era. And that's where I got really excited about disco, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, the fact that hook that you come up with is just, you're clearly meant to be writing that sort of thing, because it's such a perfect...
I'm a pop kid.
But like you said about their things being very much a sound, because remember, that sort of sits in with the other really big one was Music Sounds Better With You.
Yes.
Isn't it? At the time, and that... those are things I always sort of pigeonhole together.
Yeah. There were lots of
amazing records, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also the time when dance went commercial, because before that, house and garage and music had been kind of still quite fairly cult. And then suddenly in 2000, it tipped over into people, you know, hearing those songs on Radio 1 and on adverts and things like that. That's when house went really commercial. So I was kind of riding that wave a little bit and experiencing it. But it's funny.
Just talk about how that record came into your life and what you, and you know, the story of you meeting him and singing over that.
Well, at first I was really offended that I'd been sent it, if I'm honest, because I'd this is back in the days of getting a CD in the post. So I sent this CD with the instrumental of Groove Jet on it, and I put it in my little home ghetto blaster. And I had a listen. I was like, oh, I can't believe they're sending me a house track. This is so offensive. I'm an indie artist. How dare they? And I think I stopped it halfway through and kind of threw it across the room. I was just like, nah. And then a couple of weeks later, I was tidying up my flat and I found this CD and I was like, what's that again? I put it on and I thought, oh, you know what? There's something in this I quite like, actually. And at the time, I was managed by a guy called Martin Hall. So he managed The Audience, and he also managed and still does the Manic Street Preachers. So again, still very much part of that indie world. And he was on holiday. So I phoned up the number that had come through with this CD, and it was a guy at EMI, Positiva. And I went for a meeting on my own while my manager was away. And then when he came back, I said, I went for a meeting about this song and I actually think I'm going to do it. And when the song came out, so it was released on a Monday, and on the Tuesday, Martin met me for a drink in Camden and said, I can't manage you. I wish you all the best, but I don't understand what you're doing with this song at all. Wow. And I think that really shows you again how sort of separate all the genres were at that era.
Wow, yeah.
That's amazing.
So when the song charted, I had no manager, no record label, no plan, actually. But it was quite exciting because I'd come off the back of this failure.
You probably ended up making more money and having more success.
But I think what made that record so different and so big was you still had an indie voice. You didn't just sing it like all those other singers did with their, you know, on those dance records. You still had a very English quality about you. And I remember buying this record, Sophie.
Really?
And, well, I got the CD. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a great, great record. I got the CD. And I took it back. And my boy Finn at that time, I don't know, what year was this? 97?
2000.
So he's 10, right? And I remember having it. And he looked at it and he said, "She's very pretty, Dad." I went, "Yes, she is. She is very pretty. Yeah, yeah." And the next day I came down and he'd taken the CD and he'd scrubbed your face out with an ink pen.
Oh, what had I done to upset him?
Because I said you were pretty as well. And he was like, oh my God, you know.
Oh, wow. So he made him feel weird about it.
He was trying to protect me from...
That reminds me of like when Jamie Oliver was just releasing his books, and I remember saying to my boy Sonny, who's now nearly 20, I went, "Oh, I love Jamie Oliver," and then he was really like, "This is terrible, but you're married to Daddy, how dare you say you love another man?" Yeah. Same sort of feeling, I probably.
But it still works, that song. I mean, I played it on stage with you once, and I mean it's kind of timeless, isn't it?
If it is, then I don't think that's any credit to me. I think that taking that sample is so clever. The original song, "Love Is You," by Carol Williams, is a lovely song, but the strings are just so lush, and I think, you know, there's so much soul and heart in the musicianship of songs that were recorded in that time. So you get that the sort of essence of that in the recording, and then put it with, you know, the sort of freshness and reincarnation of it. I think it kind of gives it automatically a little bit of a soul, really. And so many dance records that I really love have done the same thing, where they've taken a sample, so it's kind of got something already that gives it character.
But it's the thing is that I what Gary was saying, like, about the, I would say with the vocal, is that most of the dance records of that time, which were based around a sample, and there'd be one vocal hook, right, one repeated vocal hook, which was usually at a pitch of sort of hysteria. Do you know what I mean? Number five. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that was you. Oh, that was you.
Yeah. Well.
So it was good. The complete opposite of that.
Yeah, well, I definitely came at it with my, you know, the way I had always thought about music. So I was like, well, there's verse one, and then you've got verse two, and you've got to have a middle eight. I definitely wanted all those things in there, and I think, you know, much to the PR for Groove Jets. Pain. I kept saying in interviews, I don't like dance music, but it's because I didn't know that world. I didn't really know what the rules were or how the form was. I just knew what I liked and how I came at things. So,
but also coming
bring,
from
isn't
indie,
it? You bring, yeah.
Coming from indie, the whole thing of how you talk to the press is saying you don't like things. You know,
definitely.
It's like
the whole
Oasis model, isn't it? It's like
so true.
Everything's shit. What I do, shit. What everyone does.
It's so true. That is so true.
You sang with the Manics, didn't you? At one point?
Yes, I did. I sang on the B side a song called "Black Holes for the Young." Yeah, because of our we had this the same manager, so I used to see them around, and in fact I saw in the Millennium watching them play at Cardiff Millennium Stadium, so yeah, they were very much part of what I was up to in the sort of late 90s, really.
Our second guest we've had on, the who's sung with the Manic Street Preachers,
who's that? Who's the first?
The Anchoress.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah,
of course.
Yes,
of course. Sorry, I
knew that.
So with Read My Lips, that was, in a way, that was, I mean, your life had changed, and suddenly were people pushing you at songwriters? Because there was this kind of moment, wasn't there, when everyone had to write with a hundred other people to make an album. There was it wasn't, which we'll get onto, where you're just with one producer. It was this thing of having multi-produced records.
Well, also just like Greg Alexander was like huge at that point.
A brilliant pop writer, Greg, and I'd obviously come off, you know, he had success with his own band too, with "You Only Get What You Give" and "New Radicals." Yeah. And
which I still love. Do you know what I love? Because he's basically Todd Rundgren. That's kind of what he's writing.
Yeah, I love it too. He's very open-hearted, actually, when he writes, which I really like. It's quite sort of puppy dog, like, hey. But I think I found myself a solo artist completely by default. So I'd lost my band, which made me, therefore, a solo artist. So when I came to do my album, I just remember thinking, I have to seize this with both hands. And having the band fall away and, you know, being able to sort of work out where the blame lay, I'd had a sort of moment where I thought, I don't ever want to be doing that ever again. I need to be able to take responsibility for what I get up to from here on in, so that if it all doesn't work out, it's on me. So I think that making that album was incredibly exciting, but there was definitely a part of me that stayed quite sober, because I thought, I really don't want to get this wrong, and I want to make the album that really represents me. And obviously you don't make it, it's never like 100% perfect with that, but it was an experience where every time I worked with someone I liked, I clung on to them a little bit. And actually there's so many people I work with now that I still work with from that time, which is really lovely. So it means, you know, now I've got these very long relationships. But literally the woman who filmed my video for Take Me Home, Sophie Muller, I still work with her. People who did the artwork, people who did my hair and makeup, and a lot of the writers as well. I've just kept those threads going because I was like, ah, I've fallen on my feet with you, right, cling together. And then it stays communal.
Yeah. Not me though.
Hey, you've done more than one thing with me. No. Come on, cheeky.
Okay. I'm checking.
for a young girl, right, which you probably, you know, you were at the time. I mean, suddenly sort of doing this speed dating writing,
yeah,
going to all these different studios, mostly with men, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Moby and Greg. And was that really challenging?
Well, the sort of maleness aspect, I'd already been experiencing that for a while, because the NME Brat Bus tour that I mentioned that I did when I was 18, straight out of school, I was the only girl on the tour. Like, all the out of four acts on the bill, I was the only girl. So I'd already had to kind of get my head around that, which I might add, coming from an all-girl school, like, just previously, was definitely a bit of a shock to the system. And I don't,
who were the other acts?
Stereophonics, Asian Dub Foundation, and the Warm Jets. So yeah, that was already something that I found a little bit challenging. I just wasn't that used to male company like that. I didn't really have any male friends. I didn't have a big brother, nothing like that. So that was already my, you know, experience. So by the time I got to the pop world, that felt a little bit more, that was so much the norm, I don't think I even thought about it. But I definitely found the kind of committee aspect of songwriting, and also, you know, I'd write a load of songs and then I'd think to myself, right, I want to play them to the label with no prejudice. I don't want them to know who I wrote these songs with. But it didn't matter that I thought that, because whoever I'd written with would already have sent it over to the label already, so they'd already know. And I felt like everything was so attached to pedigree and name and, you know, the who's who. And I just found that all a bit icky, really. But through it all, I did definitely work with people that I was having a nice time with, and some people where I thought, you know what, the way you write is not for me. And in fact, there was some writers I worked with that were very good at writing pop songs, but it was so joyless that when we came to, they said, oh, let's do another one, I said, you know what, I can't write like that, you know. Right. If I'm going to make pop music and dance music, I need to be happy and dancing around the room at the end of the session. So if we're not doing that, I'm out.
So you arrive and they've normally got a backing track already, or do you coming up from scratch in the room?
A mixture, I think. I mean, so for example, out of the four singles, you've probably got a mixture of everything. So there was a song, so Move This Mountain, which is one I did with Alex James. So I think that one, he had some chords and I started doing I do top line mainly. So writing at the top. Music Gets the Best of Me was a song I wrote with Matt Rowe and Greg Alexander, all of us in the room. So we start from nothing and just build it from the ground up. And then songs like Get Over You and Murder had a kernel of what they were, and then I would meet them at a certain point and then I'd, you know, get involved. And like with Murder, Greg was very generous and said, right, I've got, this is as far as I've got, and if you can finish it, then it's yours, kind of thing. So that was how I met that song. And then Take Me Home was a cover of a Cher song that I kind of reworked a little bit, but the original is so glorious. I was like, I have to have
it. Yeah, but you changed the lyrics, didn't you? How did that go down?
Well, I changed the lyrics. Okay, it's a bit it's quite funny this. So basically, I'd never written before Groove Jet. So Groove Jet was the first thing I'd written. And then I realised, oh, actually, I quite like writing. And not only do I quite like it, I think it's quite important because it means that it potentially sends out a message to people that maybe there's a little bit more to me than just, you know, here's a song, get on that stage and sing. You know, you've got a little bit more authority, a little bit more say. So keen to set myself out as, you know, a more serious kind of pop star, please. I tell a fib, basically, that with my reworked version of Take Me Home, I said that Cher had heard my version and didn't like it. None of that was true. I've literally got no idea if Cher's ever heard my version of Take Me Home or not. I just thought, well, at least that way people will know that I songwrote some of these lyrics.
Yeah, but the publisher agrees.
That's very savvy. That's the sort of thing Madonna would have done.
Is it?
About the,
cool.
The Pope's excommunicated me. Or, yeah. Exactly.
I just thought I'd try it. I told one journalist and it just like flew and I was like, oh, that's quite fun. it's definitely a giggle.
Before we get on to Guy's entrance into this story, he's waiting patiently in the wings. I can see
he
that
is.
Now.
Revving up.
He's already got his makeup and his ruff on.
Bass guitar just slightly out of the vision.
Spear in hand. Because Moby also hunted you down, didn't he? Apparently he was like desperate to work with you as well.
I mean, I loved working with him because he had some amazing sounds. So I flew over to New York. He played me a load of instrumentals. And one of them, it was like this snowy time in New York, and I was in my hotel room looking out and I could see all these little windows, little rooms, and I thought, so I wrote this song sort of thinking about peering into all these little windows. So it was a song called Is It Any Wonder? But then he kind of confused me, because then he didn't want to have Moby written on the credits. He wanted his name Richard Hall, which is his real name. So I was a bit like, oh, I thought you were happy to be involved, but I don't know. I haven't seen him again since, but I think he's definitely talented. I mean, at the time his album Play was absolutely everywhere, and yeah, it was kind of a mixture of exciting and also a little bit lonely, because I was traveling around a lot. So I would go there, or I'd go to Sweden or wherever I was heading off to songwrite. And then you'd find yourself, you know, at the end of the day, just on your own back in the hotel room with no one to play with. And you're like, is this okay? Am I having a nice time? Probably, possibly.
Yeah.
It's funny you say about Sweden, because there was a thing, because, you know, there was this period where we were all writers. Right? Mm. Everyone was just trying to get the pop songwriting bag. Mm. And there was so much Sweden action. Everyone was Swedish.
Yeah.
I mean, my publisher actually joked to me that I should maybe change my name to Guy Geisen.
Well, look, you know, Sweden has a long-running, you know, legacy of pop and songwriting. So
it's funny. You know, why?
Yeah, I don't know. But really good stuff can come out of it. But I think... I think that was one trip where I went and I remember just feeling a little bit far from home. I think it took me a little while to get my head around travel, and also find the best thing you can do is to involve people. So for me, when I started traveling for promoting the album, so the other side of the coin, and I was able to travel with my friend Lisa, who was doing my hair and makeup, then it was fun. Then it's like, okay, I've got a friend now. So, and we still do think, you know, she was with me last week on a trip, and it's like, that completely flips the script about how you're feeling. But those beginning bits of writing the album and, you know, amassing songs and then trying to kind of tell a story in an album is so much harder in pop music.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Murder on the Dance Floor. You've already given us a hint. It started from the beginning with you and Greg, and you suddenly had this song. And I guess he puts down a sort of rough bass, doesn't he? Or where do you get the phone call at that point, Guy?
I'd love to hear your
story of it.
What I remember of it is, as far because I Jeremy Wheatley, who was at that, because I wasn't really, the funny thing is, this was a period when I wasn't really a bass player.
Oh.
Anymore. I'm still playing, but I had my studio at the townhouse.
He was a comedian.
And I was just writing.
Yeah.
I was writing musicals with Gary, I was writing music for TV, and I still play, and I used to get sessions from just being in the townhouse. The only regular work I had at that point was Jeremy Wheatley. God bless him, Jeremy. But the funny thing with working for Jeremy was, I used to get the feeling it wasn't that he'd be trying to finish a mix And you think, I just can't get this to sit right. And it'll take me about 5 hours. Or I could get Guy in. Mm. He'll do it in about an hour and that'll be fine. So I was always this thing of like, wouldn't it be great to have Guy on this? It'll just be like, if I get Guy in, I can be out of here by five.
No, but it is genius because it really brought the song together. It didn't sound like it did.
It's still the fastest thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Right. It's literally the first thing I played was that line.
Wow.
It literally fell out of the bass. And I think I did it because I think you'd actually kind of made the record.
Yes.
He was just doing a radio mix.
He was doing additional
production. So the record was done.
Yeah, but it sounded quite different before Jeremy got involved, actually. So that part of the song's story is hugely significant because that's basically what made it disco. It wasn't really like that before.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm so glad that all happened.
Go on, Sophie.
And it was in Steve Dewberry's studio, wasn't it? Because I had my little studio down in the basement of the townhouse. And Jeremy literally knocked on my door and said, would you come and play bass on this thing for me? I went, yeah, sure. So I literally opened my door and walked 3 feet across the corridor.
Perfect.
And there was you standing in the studio.
You walked with your 3 feet. Across the
scene. By 3 feet, yeah. But it was always awkward.
Jake the Pate.
Picked Betsy off the wall, stepped across the studio, and then that bass line fell out.
Gorgeous.
So is that the only version that came out, or did the original ever come out as well, Sophie?
That was the only version that came out, that version. And, hugely significant. And, I mean, all roads lead to bass. I end up marrying a bass player, so you know it's very much part of everything I do.
You're like the Joni Mitchell of dance pop, like that.
If I had a penny for every time that was champion. Said to me, I have a whole penny right now.
why did you say that, Guy? I can't see. What's the code?
Because Joni Mitchell was the great champion of bass players, wasn't she? She discovered Jaco Pastorius. Mm-hmm. She married Larry Klein. Oh, she made an album about Charlie Mingus. Mm.
Sophie doesn't like you, though. She's already told me that.
But anyway, I do want to say that it is, and that's why I loved when we had the cross-pollination thing during lockdown, because your amazing kitchen disco, which I used to love plugging, because I did Murder on the Dance Floor in my YouTube videos, then you were doing Like a Prayer, and I was there.
Yeah.
And it's nice because Murder on the Dance Floor, like I said, has probably now topped Like a Prayer as my great pop moment.
Oh, so, Like a Prayer, like literally one of the best pop records ever, and I cover it like pretty much every gig I do now. And I love it because to me it's like, because of you playing bass on both, it's like, they're kind of cousins. My song's related to that song. So that's nice.
All right. Now get off. You've overstayed your welcome. I'm not talking to you, Sophie. I'm talking to her. So you went out with George Michael, didn't you? I mean, you didn't go out with George Michael.
I think date.
You went on tour with George Michael. I did.
I supported him on 8 dates. And then I feel sad because people ask me about it. And my anecdotes are a little bit small because I didn't actually get to meet him. But I did get to hear his voice every night, which was just sensational. He was going through a phase of being incredibly private. So he would just go into his room. He had one of those corridor blocking sort of curtain things so you couldn't see into his room when you walked past by accident. I never even saw, you know, the back of him walking somewhere. He was just keeping himself to himself and then pop up and sing every night. But his voice...
But he found it incredibly difficult, didn't he? Just being on tour. They used to do everything they could to make it, but it was just really...
Yeah, that would make sense. And at the time, my eldest wasn't very old. And I remember there was one night where they said, after tonight's show, George can see you to say hello. And I was like, I have to go home tonight because it's the only night I'll be home, you know, this weekend or whatever. So I chose my baby over George Michael, which I...
But was Richard always in your band from then on?
No, he wasn't touring with me then at all, actually. So Richard and I met when I had my first ever solo tour and I needed a band. So I met him in the audition room. So he did that first tour with me and then another tour with me. And then when we started dating, things were taking off for him with The Feeling. So he went and did that. So actually, when I was doing my sort of third, fourth, and even... Yeah, but he didn't work with me again really till around the fifth album, actually. Yes, there was quite a long bit where he was off doing his thing and I was doing mine separately.
Because that you stayed in that dance world for quite a while. I mean, I absolutely love the thing you did with Freemasons. I love the heartbreak.
Me too.
Yeah.
So good.
That's one of my favourites, actually.
Also, I must say, when I moved to Brighton, it was through Richard then introduced me to James from the Freemasons, who's still one of my greatest friends in the world.
He's such a lovely man. So talented.
He's amazing. So, yeah, that's something else to thank you for.
Yeah, how did that one come about? Was that another sort of like, did the record companies make these suggestions, or have you now got your super list that you
want? Yeah. I think record companies Kathy can put Dennis, people. Exactly. Yeah, I think people can. You know, you can be put together with people. But actually, like you guys know, like we've been talking about already so much just in our conversation. So much of this is about who you get on with. You know, who becomes friends with you, how much fun you have, how easy it is to work together, and then there's a happy moment that I think that can happen where you look around when you're working and you realise everybody you're working with, you've actually got a relationship with outside of work. I think that's kind of what you're hoping for, especially if you do something creative, because for it just to be a sort of transactional relationship doesn't really quite work, because you have to bring yourself into the room. You have to bring your experiences into what you're hoping to put into the music and your performance. So I think for me, like the fact that I now work with so many people where they've got those relationships. So with the Freemasons, I was working with a lovely songwriter called Biff, or Richard Stannard, his real name is. We always have such a lovely time together. And he had moved to Brighton and he knew the Freemasons. And I was aware of their work because I love their sound. So we got a couple of backing tracks from them. And we did Heartbreak and another song called Bittersweet. And through that, I met with James and Russell. And just a really lovely, like kind of halcyon period. Because for me, the way that they came at the sonics of dance music and pop is exactly the same as the things I liked. So I was very happy working with them.
But what was sort of a shocking in a way for all your disco dance fans was you suddenly sort of changed and broke away and decided to make an album, which I love.
A folk album.
With Ed Harcourt, you know, and just one producer, one other songwriter, folk, kind of
Eastern
based,
European,
you know,
feel.
I mean, utterly different style. Yeah. Were there lots of people screaming, "No, don't do it"?
I've got no idea, but just for sort of context of the,
didn't ask.
Yeah,
why did you make that choice?
So I think there's a couple of things at play. One thing is I have a tendency to run in one direction and then kind of like a pinball, like boing to the other side of it. Really, I kind of quite like flipping things. I think, obviously, going from indie to dance was one of those. And then when I got to my fourth album, that was probably my most clubby. So I'd always been the sort of pop, disco, dance mood. And then by the time I got to the fourth album, it was working
Make
with Calvin. Yeah, so I did it at Calvin Harris, Armin Van Buuren, like proper like clubby DJs. So I'd sort of like gone quite far into that. And then during that time, I'd also left Universal. So they'd given me back that album. So I released that album under my own steam, but I wasn't with Universal anymore. I was 34 years old and I felt like I was kind of, everything had got a little bit predictable in my world. I was singing lots of corporate gigs and everything was fine, but it wasn't really challenging me hugely. And I thought, I think I need to completely pull the rug out from underneath me, actually. I think I need to just go for broke and do something completely different. So I'd got to this point where I decided that in order to make another record, I was going to have to self-fund it. So that was the option I chose for making Wanderlust. So I didn't have a record company. There was no one I needed to play stuff to. There was no one that needed to give me the thumbs up. So I just had an absolute ball making a record where I just lost myself in the process of it. And I was like, right, no dance, no disco, no four on the floor. I want to make something completely different. And I want to tell stories. I want to do things I can't do in the world of pop and dance. Pop and dance is so brilliant at dealing with a here and now. I'm in love. I'm feeling flirtatious. I'm excited. I'm scared. I'm all those heady emotions. But you can't really be reflective. You can't go, oh, there was a moment at some point in the last year where I felt this. It doesn't work in dance music. Dance is like, come on, tell me what's going on in like your frontal lobe or whatever. So I was like, I need to tell stories. So Ed and I, we wrote, the first thing we did was a waltz.
How did you meet them, Sophie?
I was going to say, I was wondering what came, the chicken and egg.
Okay.
Ed wanted to do that.
So I knew of Ed before I met him properly, really. He's such a, like, He's an amazing guy, very talented musician and a proper character, just capable of creating beauty with his music and absolute like chaos on a night out. You know, just one of these guys you hear about.
And he's in a band with Richard as we speak.
Yes, exactly. So
Loop Guru.
Loop Guru, yeah. Exactly. And so I'd sort of heard of him, and then I'd met his wife Geeta, and then I was working with a producer called Dimitri Tikhovoy, and he was doing some stuff with Ed, and he and Ed did a little backing track for me, which I ended up writing on top of, and it became a bonus track on my fourth album. So that was the first thing we'd sort of done, but it was sort of remote. And then after that, we just did our paths across socially. And I think it was probably Richard, to be fair. He probably said, you should try writing a song with Ed. And Ed was open to writing with other people. So we went to his little studio, which was then on Beethoven Street, in sort of Kilburn Way. And I said, right, let's just write a waltz. Nothing will happen with this. We're like, well, this is not for anything. Let's just write a song I can't normally write. So we wrote about this witch who, when she takes your photograph, she steals your soul. And it became this song called Love is a Camera. And I just walked away feeling really nourished. And like, God, that felt good. So I just said to him, I think we just follow this. I think that's song one. And Wanderlust was one of the most sure-footed experiences of songwriting I've ever had, because we didn't have any extra songs. We wrote 12 songs. Those songs were the album. My manager, you know, look, I've been with the same manager, Derek, for a very long time. It's probably approaching 20 years. And he's been incredibly supportive, but he didn't really get what I was up to with Wanderlust. Fair enough. He was worried about me. He wanted to make sure that what I was doing was going to be commercially successful. And, you know, his pop artist is like, hey, I'm just doing some Bavarian waltzes over here. Don't mind me.
Let's
So he was like, maybe we get an A&R. Like, let's pay an independent A&R. And I was like, you know what? No. Look, I've worked for 10 years with Universal. I've put in lots of work. This is my equivalent of buying myself a sports car. I'm going to buy myself an album. No one's going to tell me what they want to do with it. So I kind of like went a little bit hibernated, really. Richard was very involved, incredibly supportive. And then, so we wrote the album. We went into a studio. We recorded the whole thing in 10 days. And it was just really bliss. I absolutely loved it. And then I went and did Strictly Come Dancing. So it was like a really weird year for me. But it was just one of those years where it was all about what happens if I do the thing that's like a little bit scary? Like, what's the worst that can happen? Maybe it won't work out. I've probably got time to dust myself down and do something else.
I don't know if this was around that period, because I remember seeing you playing a benefit gig with Ed for a boxing gym on Harrow Road.
Yes. Yes, we did that, singing in the ring, like literally performing in the ring.
Yeah, you were literally in the ring. It was great.
Yeah, that was I think that was probably after we'd done the second album. But Ed and I, we had it was just a weird thing. We were really happy writing together, and we decided, right, this is album one. We're going to do three. So even before we'd finished writing Wanderlust, we were like, this is one of three. I don't know why we had that rule, but we did.
Yeah,
and actually, making some rules is quite good for making your brain work a different way. So I enjoyed that.
No, but I love these albums. They do get played quite a bit in our house as well. And the depth of them. But it's your lyric writing, I think, that's really powerful. You know, they're, you mentioned storytelling, but there really is a sense. I mean, the last album you've done with him, Hannah, I mean, there's some, it's an incredible, it's almost a concept album, really, isn't it? Based around what's gone on in your life. Recently,
definitely. Well,
there's a lovely thing you said about it, which is, because what is this Japanese word for blossom? Mm. But this idea of, like, it's someone's imagining a place that they haven't been to that they are going to.
Exactly.
Like that.
So when I started writing Hannah, I was about to go to Japan for the first time. And so I wrote some songs based on what I thought the trip would be like. So I knew I'd be going with my mum and my eldest boy. So I wrote a song called Tokyo about how it would feel when we were there. But I hadn't been there yet. And then you have that weird bit where you go there, and then every night when I'd get into my bed at night, the song would be kind of going around my head, so it sort of becomes infused, a bit like a sort of deja vu dream kind of feeling. But I think as well, Hannah was really about how music works for me. So on the one hand, it was all, you know, in and out of pandemic, lots of fun. So on the one hand, you know, you've got heavy news and stuff going on, and my lovely stepdad died very early on in 2020. So you've got all that infused while I'm also doing these crazy kitchen discos with Richard and the kids, putting on sequin cat suits, like, hey, here's some cover versions, here's some disco music, just because it made me feel better. Like, what a tonic. But Hannah was the other thing I needed. I needed a place to put all the other emotions, things that were maybe a little bit more introspective, a little bit more introvert. And I mean, aren't we lucky that we get to do that when you have a day where you think, I've got this strange feeling I'm being a bit discombobulated, and then you can just put it into a song and then like, God, I feel so much better. It's like proper got like therapy aspects for me, I think.
Some beautiful lyrics. I think there's ones, because you weren't meant to be on that trip to Japan.
I was not.
And,
that's right.
And you even begin a song by saying, you know, I wasn't meant to be here or something like that.
I wasn't supposed to come.
And because it was your stepfather that was meant to go on that trip. So
that's right.
You know, and I think there's that you know, journey that you take us on that was, that you know, that almost a diary that you're opening for us in that album is exquisitely done.
Oh, thank you. But also, like, what I just feel like it was such a nice thing that I had that, because after everything, I found the first aspect of the pandemic so, I was so paralyzed. I couldn't think of any new ideas. So when I started to sort of come into songwriting again and work that muscle again, it was so lovely to have that. And yeah, I mean, I know, you know, people probably find the idea of, you know, a pop album that involves grief a bit like, oh, is that a happy bedfellow? But actually, I think music's long been a place where you can get juxtaposition and beauty and all those things. And it
it's hugely uplifting.
Doesn't have to be sad to be to have all those emotions. So yeah, I think that song, and there's another one as well called Until the Wheels Fall Off, and that was, some of those words were directly lifted out of the memorial that John had written for himself. So it was the words that he knew would be spoken after he died, and a family friend read them out, and I thought that some of it was just so beautiful, but also so much of it was about giving all of us permission to really live. And there's such generosity in that, isn't there, to say to everybody you leave behind, oh my goodness, life is wonderful, seize it, light your, you know, the posh scented candle, drink the good wine, don't save things for this other day, like, it's all about now.
Your kitchen disco was amazing, you know.
It was amazing.
It was a real, real tonic for us. I remember, you know, our lockdown family looking forward to those Fridays or whatever. It was Friday, you know, and quick, Sophie's on. Let's.
That's so sweet. And like, probably, you know, what's happening now? Who's climbing the wall behind her?
Yeah. And also, you know, people are often concerned about, you know, getting their kids on social media. This was like, you know what? This is our family. This is who we are.
There was absolutely.
Yeah, I'd never involved.
So it was Richard's idea. I didn't know what to do with myself. We'd gone into sort of like an early lockdown. One of the kids had a cough, and you probably can remember it was that era where, like, if someone had a cough, everybody had to like shut down because it might be that cough, and then you're at home for 2 weeks. Like, oh great. So I was already feeling like, oh no, why didn't I keep going with my piano lessons? Why didn't I keep with my guitar? I can't accompany myself on anything. This is rubbish. And then Richard said, well, why don't you sing some of your songs with the backing tracks and we'll just do a gig here? And I was like, that is such a crazy idea, but I do not have a better one, and I also got nothing else on, so sure, why not.
But you started off with your own tracks, didn't you? You had a lot of covers which were things that you'd played, that you'd done.
Well, again, there were rules, so I would do some songs of mine that I did every week, and then I would always do like an older one, and then maybe a kind of like slightly deep cut one, and then a cover version of something as well. And that was so good for my head because it gave me something to learn. So every week I'd be like doing all the usual domestic stuff and looking at the heaviness on the news, but then also trying to memorize, you know, Spoonful of Sugar or something. and then we would do this thing, which I used to call the after party, because I was like, actually, I want to be able to sing other songs that maybe aren't the big, like, disco, happy, dancey songs, but maybe I'd do, like, I don't know, a song from Moana, or I'd do, like, A&E by Goldfrapp, or just something a bit, like, in another space. And it just made me happy. It made my heart happy. I loved having people come round. I loved the connection. I loved the immediacy of seeing the comments, just that connection. Like, I didn't have any idea how important that was to me in my equilibrium until it was taken away. And then I was like, right, I need it. I just need it. So yeah, it became really important to me.
How many hits was it getting? How many views was it getting?
Well, it's hard to say, but we've got a friend called Chris Salmon who, he was kind of like the other person that was really helping us. So Richard and I were the ones at home. Richard did an amazing job on all the technical side. And then we'd send the music files to Chris Salmon, who would upload them onto the socials, because that's not something I've got the skill set for. And Chris worked out that he said the reach was somewhere around 40 million. But I don't really know what that means. Like, I don't know if that means like people could literally just swipe past it or whatever. I think it just means that that was kind of like in the ballpark of how far reaching it went. It's quite mind blowing, especially when we weren't seeing anybody. Like, it's literally seeing no one.
Because what's fun, the thing you're saying, that getting people to do things because everyone was locked down. When I started doing my videos, my thing, did my first one, then it was rubbish and put it up. And like 10 editors got in touch and just said, let me edit your video.
That's cool.
Let me do it. Yeah, it was fantastic. Because everyone, because we're stuck at home. We haven't got anything to do.
Including me. So, I wanted to edit him out of it. but obviously, wait, if one person's watching it on the phone, the whole family's watching it. That's how we were watching it. Us and our three
or
kids.
Or people on their own. Or it was there for however. I mean, I understood that for most people, they'd put it on, lean their phone up on the side, go and, you know, make their supper, whatever they're up to. But I think it's just having that, that contact with people just became so good for my sanity, even though it looked like insanity.
Let's talk about Saltburn. How did that happen?
So, must have been about a year ago. I got an email, you know, a standard one asking for permission to use Murder on Dance Floor in a film. And it just said a few details. Film's called Saltburn, written and directed by Emerald Fennell, and that they wanted to use all of the song, and it would be a character dancing to the whole thing naked through the halls of this house. And that was kind of it, really. And I thought, oh, that sounds quite fun. And how nice that she wants to use the song, because I'd watched her previous film, Promising Young Woman, and thought it was really good. So I was like, oh, that's nice. And then I actually forgot all about it because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with things. And I forgot to tell Richard, and I didn't tell my manager, actually. So when these little murmurs started happening last summer about the film and about the soundtrack, I had to then sort of explain to them what I knew. And we got invited to a screening.
Well, how did it go? Like, Richard,
you got flown out to LA, didn't you?
Did you explain it by going, Richard, there's a naked man, right?
Well, he was like, what's this thing about the songs in... actually, it's actually even more peculiar than that. So basically, Richard had gone along to our youngest's end of nursery picnic in the park. And one of the other dads is a guy called Mark Robinson, who works at Universal doing the soundtrack. So he said, oh, the soundtrack's actually really impressive. And then Richard's like, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. So between the two of them, they were like, oh, we should probably organise a screening. You should see it. So there's often a kind of more like, I don't know, social aspect to these things, isn't there? And trotted along, not knowing anything about the movie. So watched the screening with my mum and my eldest boy, Sonny, and my brother and his girlfriend, Richard. And it's quite an extraordinary film. It was quite quite intense for like a Tuesday morning at 10 a.m.
But
we all really loved it. We did all really love it. And by the time I got to the end, I'd sort of forgotten that's why I was there, actually. And then Murder starts playing, and it's really hard, isn't it, to be objective if it's like a song you know so well. It's hard to like see it bedded in. But I did think, I love the fact he's dancing to it naked. Like, it's so hedonistic. It's so liberating. Like, how brilliant. But I didn't actually think it was going to do as much as it's done with the film or the song. I've got a really bad antenna for that kind of thing. So I liked it.
Did Emerald want the song? Did she write that into the script?
She did, she did. Because I actually met her for coffee straight after the screening, and she was like, there was literally no other song. It had to be that song. So she was like, I didn't know, have another plan for if you'd said no. And I think, looking at the film, I think she's clearly one of those directors who, you know, infuses the soundtrack in, you know, it's sealed when she's writing, because all the music has really got such proper placement, and it sounds great, and it really works. Like, they're very well tessellated, aren't they, the two, I think.
I think you're very lucky to have written a great classic disco song with the word murder in it. I mean, who knew that was going to pan out?
Yeah, but that is going to come back and bite me, because you know, as soon as I die, that is going to be the joke. I used to think I had to just not die in a nightclub. I was like, so long as I don't get killed in a nightclub, I'll be fine. But now I've realised, don't be dull. It doesn't matter. I could die like in my sleep, 110, and they'll be like, did you hear she died? And someone will go, was it murder on the dance floor? It literally won't matter how I die. It's just going to happen. And even
Sophie Ellis Bexter, they killed the groom.
There you go. See how annoying is that? Sorry. I can't escape it. I can't escape my pun future.
Or now, of course, with your great success on this song, and you've got you might have your own private jet, and it'd be called Groove Jet, of course.
Yeah. The jet might have to wait.
What we all want, because we all look for what's called synchronizations, where we, you know, as songwriters, your music gets used on a film, and you know, I've had that happen quite a lot. But what I haven't had happen is where, apart from on Grange Hill, actually, I think they danced the True because it was important to them. But I haven't had it in part of the story to get it as part of the story.
Yeah, that's unusual, isn't it?
So unusual. And obviously this has blown up, because now, I mean, I had Richard texting me every other day telling me how it was, you know, number 14 in the global chart.
Sorry, he went so crazy on stats, I had to tell him to stop. It was actually making me feel a bit sick. I was like, I can't do it. I'm not very good with that kind of thing, because...
Well, you need to hire Gary. Gary is literally the Bill Frindle.
Yeah, she doesn't know who Bill Frindle is. Bill Frindle,
he's Mr. He does all the cricket stats.
Yes. Thank Gary, you. I did not know who that was. I was like,
he's long dead. Yeah,
sorry.
He's long dead.
Oh, It was murder on his poor wife.
His poor wife.
But it has been extraordinarily enormous, hasn't it? I mean, you know,
it's been pretty wild. America, I'm not going to lie. Like, it's been, like, I overused the word bonkers in January a lot, and I think it's been really exciting, and I've loved so much of it. But I think, you know, and I'm sure you both can. That feeling, I don't know if everybody feels like this about things, but when things go into accelerate for me, I just need to kind of have a minute to sort of work out how I can have kind of be part of the journey rather than just be like grabbed by the scruff of the neck and dragged along. So I was like, hang on a minute, I need to try and think clearly through this. What does this really mean? What do I want? How does this work with all the things I already had planned? And I do feel like a lot more steady on my feet now. But yeah, initially I was just a bit like, I don't really know what this all means yet. And it's been so funny doing interviews, you know, in Europe again to promote Murder. And so many of them are like, so what have you been doing for 20 years? It's just like, oh, congratulations. When I got asked yesterday, so is this song being a hit again? Good revenge, because we hadn't heard from you for so long. Oh. Like, honestly, oh. Like... Jesus. No, it's not revenge. It
is, but the one question I will ask, have you had to mime to your 20-something-year-old self recently?
Well, I do lots of gigs where I sing on my own, and I'll sing to a backing track. And so in the backing track is all the BVs that I recorded then. Yeah. So I've already been so aware of this thing of like singing, harmonising with me half my life ago. So bonkers, you know, when you're in the studio recording stuff, you never think, oh, you know, 20 years from now I'll be doing the top line of what I'm doing. That doesn't occur to you. So yeah, that hasn't been lost on me before now, and I do think that's pretty wild. But what's also really funny is that because this song has come back from 22 years ago, when I've been doing promotion recently, obviously, to the people inviting me onto things, they felt it's like free season to use any photograph of me that's existed at any point in that timeline. So I have no idea which version of me will greet me when I do things. And it's like, oh, I remember that shoot I did like 14 years ago, 17 years ago, 21 years ago. Like, it's just so strange. You're not expecting to see yourself, you know, then, and then be like talking about it now. It's pretty, yeah. Mind-blowing.
Well, let me tell you how it's changed my life, which I like, which is that my social media feeds are now just full of young bass players. It's great. A lot of people who showing you how to play the bass line to Murder on the Dance Floor.
I love that.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I love all that. Well,
thank you so very, very much. Yeah, all that is brilliant.
I really love seeing all the people dancing to it.
Plus, I've checked my PPL, and that's going to be very nice as well. So thank you very, very much for that.
Well, that's good.
I'll probably buy you dinner.
People keep thinking I'm going to be super rich because of the streaming, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
When you were talking about pictures from your... you don't know what picture's going to greet you. I remember a friend of mine, Leo Abraham, said me when he was on tour with Ed Harcourt, once, and they were touring in America, and they had no budget. They were literally just playing toilets, and so because they couldn't really ask for anything in the rider, they couldn't ask for nice food or anything like that. So one stipulation Ed had was that the dressing room had to have a photograph of Ollie Reed with a beard on the wall, so that at least that one thing they had to look forward to, whatever gig they got to, was what picture of Ollie Reed with a beard is going to be on
the
wall.
That's a good game to play, isn't it? I like that.
Oh, yeah, my God.
That's great.
Has it changed? Has it thrown you off course of what you had planned to do next?
Actually, no. There's a weird amount of serendipity because I'd finished... So Hannah being the third of the three albums that Ed and I said we would write, I'd already been thinking even before Hannah was released, right, what do I do next? And I thought, I think I'll go back to the other thing that I really love. So I think I'm going to make another pop album. I'm going to make a pop dance disco album, just like I did when I started. So I'd already started putting in the diary sessions, songwriting sessions with people I'd worked in with, you know, worked on with my first, second, third album. So there's a weird sort of synchronicity with all of that. And how nice, because it puts like such good momentum and spring in your step to feel like, ah, this is the right thing at the right time. And yeah. Believe me, if I didn't want to make that kind of music, I wouldn't be doing it. I just would do something else. But it does feel like, yeah, I'm actually in the mood for that. So I've been trying to think about how I do that, that also reflects who I am and where I'm at. So I've got to make sure that it's a pop dance album that is, you know, true to the fact that I'm a 44-year-old woman. So let's see what that sounds like.
Are you
haven't
going
figured
on tour?
That bit out yet.
Are you on tour coming up?
So I was already about to go off to Europe. So I'm doing that in March. That's only my second European tour in 20 years, actually. I did the first one last year. So going back again, which will be lovely. That was already on sale before, pre-Saltburn. And then I've got a lovely tour supporting Nile Rodgers and Chic in June and July. Some festivals. And then there's a few new things popping in. So I'm sort of squidging into the gaps, really, with travel to other countries, places I haven't been to for a while. Possibly some new ones, like we're looking at maybe doing some dates in America, which would be cool because I've never done that. Right. So, yeah, right. Just sort of feeling my way, really, and just trying to seize it all, I suppose, because, yeah, I think it's all a bit once in a lifetime. So let's see what can come out of it.
No, it's lovely talking to you. Thank you, Sophie.
Fantastic,
no,
Sophie.
My pleasure.
Brilliant.
So thank nice. You.
Really, really great. And congratulations again. It's all brilliant, you know, and it's so lovely to be a tiny part.
Oh, yeah.
It's great.
Hugely. Really. I feel like everything I do has got loads of people that are connected with it, though. I don't really do anything in isolation, you know. It's always a team, really. Cheers, guys.
Oh, it's so nice. That was nice.
So nice.
Yeah, you know, really a fantastic couple as well. And what she's, you know, and their family, you know, they've got five boys. I mean,
I know.
We met them when our first boy was young, and then they had another boy born like a few days after or before our middle child. And we both called each other to say we'd just had a boy, and we both said, and it's called Kit. So they're both called Kit. And then we had another one almost at the same time. And then they went on and carried on having boys.
So you've both had children in Kit form.
Oh, my God. Why do I do this? I don't know why I do this podcast. It's so painful.
I don't know why you do it.
It's so painful. Okay.
I would like to make one little point, which is I need a shout out to Jeremy Wheatley to say how much I used to love working with him, and that might have come over as I didn't really appreciate what, you know, him getting me in as much as I actually did. So you're amazing, Jeremy. I love
you. With your 3 feet. Anyway,
brilliant.
Until then, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.